Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
too many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back with a little from a little hiatus with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I have two great guests today. We want to talk with, this is the day before the fourth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, which has not stopped. I should say it's the day before the anniversary of the beginning of the Fukushima disaster. And we have with us Rivera's son, a wonderful Occupy activist, nonviolent critic, author of The Dandelion Revolution, Love and Revolution, and a lot of other stuff. Rivera, I'm looking forward to talking to you, but we're going to start with Joe DeMar. Joe, are you there? Joe DeMar.
Yes, Harvey.
All right, very good. Okay, Joe, so let's. You are in Toledo, Ohio. We're going to be with you for a little bit, and then we'll get with Rivera's son. Tell us, you are a longtime anti-nuclear activist. I don't know if there are any new anti-nuclear activists out there, but most of the people I know have been in it for a long, long time. Maybe that's because I'm so old. But
Yes, there are new ones, Harvey. We took a bunch of people up to the People's Climate March, and I'm actually in Bowling Green.
Okay.
And we had a bunch of students. There's a student group called the Environmental Action Group. And a good 20 of them came up to the People's Climate March, and we were all part of the anti-nuclear contingent there. So, there are some new anti-nuclear activists in the world.
Glad to hear it. And I am a big advocate of merging the movements against nuclear power with the movements against fracking. And we are looking forward to a possible conference in San Francisco to do just that in May. But Joe, you are downwind at Bowling Green. You are downwind from the infamous hole in the head Davis-Besse nuclear power plant. And you've got something planned for tomorrow, the fourth anniversary of the beginning of the endless Fukushima disaster. Tell us what you got going.
All right. Well, this action is actually has become nationwide and worldwide. There's going to be people all over the planet doing this. And what it's called is Unplug Nuclear Power. And the premise is very simple. For the 24 hours of March 11th, that's the Fukushima anniversary, we're asking people to use as little grid power as possible. We want people to unplug from the grid. And the reasons for this are many. One is that it really is a direct action in a typical household by doing we have four levels. There's level one, which is just turning off extra lights and minimizing your electronics. Level two is turning off everything except your essentials. That's your sump pump and refrigerator. Level three is disconnecting from the grid. And we don't recommend this unless you've got some backup power or unless you don't need your furnace. And then level four, and you'll be very interested in this one, Harvey, level four is putting more power onto the grid through solar or wind than you use that day. And one interesting thing, this is actually the third year we're doing Unplugged Nuclear Power, and the people that are signing up on the website, the percentage that are level four has jumped way up this year. So a lot of people are finally getting the solar panels and making Solartopia happen.
Well, that's great to hear. I do want to point out before I lose track that tomorrow also there will be a major event in San Francisco. It's going to be at the they're marching around. It's going to start at the Japanese Consulate at 275 Battery Street, in San Francisco, and people will gather there to demand that the world take over at Fukushima, because right now the Fukushima disaster, which is ongoing, it is responsible for continuous major dumps of radioactive material into the Pacific Ocean and into the atmosphere. And according to this press release from the great organizer Ruthie Sackheim, who works with the Occupy group out in San Francisco, there is, of course, a growing thyroid epidemic, an epidemic of thyroid cancer cases downwind in the region from Fukushima. 300 tons of radioactive water continue to dump into the Pacific Ocean at Fukushima. There is no real improvement, no clarification for the public about what's going on there. As a matter of fact,
That was 300 tons every day.
Every day, that's correct. 300 tons a day. And every day, the Fukushima information flow, as much radioactive water is pouring into the ocean, the flow of information is being stopped by, and I use this term advisedly, the fascist government in Japan. Fascism, the definition of fascism, is corporate control of the state, and certainly the corporations are in control of the Japanese government. The Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, has put a freeze on information. There's a state secret act in Japan. Anti-nuclear activists can and have gone to jail merely for describing various disasters at Fukushima. And so this is a serious situation. We don't really know what's going on at Fukushima, but it's not good. And it, 4 years after, there's no sense that it's going to that it's under control. So you, Joe DeMar, out there in Bowling Green, is there a Japanese consulate in Bowling Green?
No, but actually, I'll be going up to the Japanese consulate in Detroit. So I'll be passing through Toledo and hopefully picking up a few people. And it's about a three-hour drive. And I wanted to support your comment about fascism there and using it in the technical sense. It turns out that Prime Minister Abe's political party gets it's between 60% and 3/4 of its donations actually come from the corporation TEPCO, the company that owns the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. So very, very much in control of that party.
Yeah, and you know, it's disturbing to know that other major industrial countries are owned and operated, like the United States, by major corporations. And in this case, that's a shocking statistic. But the Liberal Democratic Party, which is neither liberal nor democratic, and it's certainly not much of a party, is completely corrupted, has been for decades. But I didn't realize that TEPCO, the owner of Fukushima, is their major donor. And why in God's name is Fukushima still allowed to be privately owned? My understanding is that the disaster site has now become a profit center for TEPCO because they're getting so much government money. They're not generating electricity, but they're getting tons of public funds to allegedly clean up the place, whatever that means. They're arguing now that they want to just take all the radioactive water and just dump it in the Pacific Ocean because they're running out of storage tanks. There is no indication, really, that things are any better at Fukushima than they were 4 years ago.
No, I'd say they're getting worse. I just wanted to also say real quick that this Unplugged Nuclear Power is supported by about 40 different organizations and prominent anti-nuclear individuals around the country and around the world. Our very first organization that endorsed us was the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and they're very active in the fight against the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant.
I know the Mothers for Peace very well. One of them is actually my mother. No.
Oh, really?
No, not really. Not literally, let's put it that way. Figuratively, spiritually, they're all my mother. And I was arrested at Diablo Canyon in 1984 and taken very good care of by Ray Fleming, one of the original Mothers for Peace. And I work very strongly now with Linda Seeley, who is an ongoing Mother for Peace, and they are one of the world's great groups, and we are working very hard with them to shut the Apple Canyon, which is surrounded by earthquake faults, including one that's a mere 700 yards, the new shoreline fault, newly discovered shoreline fault, which is just, within a very short distance, less than half a mile, from the two reactor cores at Diablo Canyon, the only two remaining in California that are operable, and we hope to shut them down. What do you hope to accomplish with this action of getting people to turn off their or turn down their electricity? And Rivera-san, are you with us there, Rivera? Hello, Rivera-san? I don't hear her. Hopefully she'll be tuning in on Skype to join us soon.
This action is working on a lot of levels at once. It was kind of inspired by the actions of people like Gandhi, who went and made salt from seawater as part of the struggle against the British, and by the people who went and sat, the colored people or the black people who went and sat in diners in all white sections down in the South. You know, that those actions themselves didn't create the Civil Rights Act or get rid of the British out of rule in India, but they were direct, nonviolent, peaceful actions that took the whole narrative in that direction. And one of the things that I'm hoping people will discover is just how little we need nuclear power, because last year, 2014, nukes only supplied 19% of the electricity we used, less than 20%. And everybody can save that much power just by participating at level one, just by going around turning off the lights that don't need to be on and cutting back on their electronics for 24 hours. So that's, I want to demonstrate to people in a visceral way. And this movement has been growing every year. This is the third year. And what I would like to see eventually, because this is a long-term project also, eventually I'd like to see North America go dark on March 11th every year.
Except for the solar stuff.
Right, except for the solar stuff.
I mean, the bottom line is America's, because of solar energy, America's never going to go dark again. I mean, I'm on my way to moving to L.A., and there are tons of solar houses out there, including my daughter and son-in-law. So they can meet the qualifications of the Fukushima power down, but still keep their house lit.
Good point.
And then, of course, I have all those circular cages in my basement where the squirrels are running around, and that helps too. But look, we got tons of wind, tons of solar going on. The nuclear industry loves to lie about the realities of renewables, but this is a case where Solartopia is really moving ahead. Joe, do you know anywhere else in the world, or is it all over the world now, that people are going to Japanese consulates to commemorate the fourth anniversary, the beginning of the Fukushima accident?
Yes, there are people going all over the world. I know there's people going in France, and I'm actually, I'm more of the unplug organizer. I'm just sort of a participant in the consulate action, so I don't know a lot of the details on that. But yes, that's happening all over the world also.
Okay, great. And Rivera-san, are you with us? Rivera,
I am. Hi there, Harvey.
Hi, Rivera. How are you? Okay. So this is Joe DeMar. We're talking on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Joe DeMar is with us from Bowling Green, Ohio. And Rivera, you are with us from the wilds of New Mexico. Is that right?
That's right. I'm up in Taos.
Taos. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me continue with Joe here a bit, Rivera. You've been very patient, and we'll get to you in just a moment. Are you doing anything tomorrow to commemorate the Fukushima fourth anniversary, the beginning of the disaster?
I didn't know that there was a commemoration going on, which doesn't bode well for my network. I should know more about that. I'm glad your listeners are finding out, and I'll definitely be researching it.
Okay, so do you have solar on your home, solar panels?
We are on wind power, actually.
And well, that counts.
We can talk a little bit more about the Earthship that I live in, which I did not build, but I currently do live in it, and how we use solar predominantly for heating, but it's passive solar, so no solar panels.
Well, cool. That's wonderful, and we will do that. So Joe DeMar in Bowling Green, you are downwind from the Davis-Besse nuclear plant, and I want to slip in here while Rivera patiently waits. And Rivera, you'll have the rest of the hour when Joe departs. But the Davis-Besse nuke, we here in Ohio, and I'm talking here from central Ohio, are trying to prevent the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio from granting massive rate increases to keep that fossil nuke going. Tell us a little bit very quickly about the Davis-Besse nuke and why we need to shut it down. And we do have, for those of you listening from Ohio, a hearing coming up April 13th, 12th and 13th. We're going to have a conference in Columbus on the 12th, and the 13th we will have a rally at the Ohio Public Utilities Commission against the bailout there. Tell us real quickly, Joe, about the Davis-Besse nuke.
Well, all right, the current situation with PUCO is one of those really jaw-dropping situations. What's happened is FirstEnergy has requested from the Public Utilities Commission the right to a long-term 15-year power purchase agreement wherein the northern utility companies like Toledo Edison that buy power from FirstEnergy, they're also owned by FirstEnergy, but they buy power from FirstEnergy. They want to have a long-term power purchase agreement that allows FirstEnergy to charge them literally whatever it takes to keep the Davis-Besse nuclear power plant running. This is a power purchase agreement with no upper limit. And the reason they say this, one interesting thing, is they say that that nuclear, that Davis-Besse literally can't compete with wind power and with natural gas power. So they need a guaranteed purchase to keep Davis-Besse running. The thing is that Davis-Besse is literally falling apart. The containment dome, or what they call the shield building, has giant cracks in it. And those cracks are growing literally every time we have a freeze and a thaw up here, because they painted – the cracks were found a few years ago when they were doing repairs. And they said, oh, it was a blizzard of 77. That happened a long time ago. These cracks aren't growing. There's nothing to worry about. Let's keep running. So then they went and looked, and a few years later, lo and behold, the cracks were growing. And so then they said, well, we'll just put some a coating of paint over it, and that'll take care of it, and let's keep running. So now what's happened is that paint has sealed water inside the containment dome. And literally every time there's a freeze and a thaw, the cracks grow by half an inch. And this dome, which is many, many thousands of tons of cement and reinforced steel, is on the verge of failure.
What do you mean by failure?
What I mean is collapsing.
Wait, you're going to tell me that this giant building is just going to fall over?
If you have a giant building that is out of true and has big cracks in it, big chunks can fall out of it. And the cracks have penetrated from the outside. I believe it's about three-quarters of the way to the inside. I don't know. If you remember the hole-in-the-head fiasco, they waited until there was only 3/16 of an inch of stainless steel left between the nuke and disaster. Well, now they're waiting until these cracks propagate all the way through the containment dome. And then their theory is that the water will then seep out and everything will be wonderful.
Well, why don't you just fill those cracks with silly putty? I think that would work.
That's probably the next probably when they try to put it back together. But what this means is that Davis-Besse is going to need probably billions of dollars in repair in order to keep running. So if FirstEnergy gets this unlimited long-term power purchase agreement, they'll be able to get the billions of dollars because they will add the costs of repairing Davis-Besse to the transmission and delivery portion of everyone's bill, which means that even if you sign up for quote-unquote 100% wind power, you're still going to get hit with Davis Bessie's repair costs. They're talking billions. I mean, there was one citizens group out of Cleveland that has estimated at least $2 billion. I'm thinking more like $6 billion because that's what the Crystal River nuclear power plant was going to require to fix its cracking containment dome. They chose to shut down instead of keep going.
Well, we all know that First Energy would never do such a thing. So, Joe, I want to wrap up here real quickly. The Ohio Public Utilities Commission does have the right to turn this down.
Yes.
We hope they will. We will be marching at their headquarters April 13th. The Columbus Free Press has carried an article I've written today about Davis Bessie, and also an article by Kevin Camps, who I had on the program not long ago to talk in great detail about the nuke at Davis Bessie. One thing we have to understand on this day before the fourth anniversary of the beginning of the Fukushima disaster is that what's happening at Davis Bessie is happening at nuclear reactors all over the world. What year did Davis Bessie open, Joe? Do you know?
It's going to be 30 years as of Earth Day this year. Yeah.
So 1980? No, it opened in the 70s. You're thinking 40 years. Didn't it open in 1973 or 4?
I believe it was 30 years.
Okay. We'll take a look. There are five reactors in Illinois that are on the brink of shutdown. There's another one in New York State at Jenna.
I'm from Western New York, so.
There you go. Okay. You never contradict a native. And all over the world, nuclear reactors are just suffering from the Fukushima/Davis-Bessie syndrome, where they're falling apart and on the brink of exploding. So, Joe, we want to wish you great luck with your demonstration and your. Tell us again what you want people to do before.
Okay.
You tell us what do you want people to do with their electricity tomorrow.
Very simple. Just starting at midnight tonight, and going until midnight tomorrow night. So the 24 hours of March 11th. Just turn down grid power as much as you're able. If you can get off the grid, that's great. If you can put more power on, like your other guest, than you use, that's the best. But basically, we wanted to show the utility companies that we don't need nuclear power, and we can live without them and their dirty power.
Okay, that's the big deal. We want to live without the utilities, whether it's and King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, whether it's nuclear or coal or fracking. We want to be finished with the grid and finished with atomic energy, finished with killing our planet. Joe, what is the website people can go to find out more about what you're doing?
It's unplugnuclearpower.com, all together in one, no underlines or dashes, just unplugnuclearpower.com. And people can go there and sign up and tell us what level you're participating at and help spread the word.
All right, Joe DeMar, thank you very much. And Joe, I hope to see you in Columbus on April 12th and 13th for our conference, and you'll spread the word about it. We can stop Ohio from, and shutting down, stop Ohio from funding this ridiculous sickness and shutting down Davis Bessie will be a huge global relief.
Can I just say one more quick thing about that?
You can. Rivera Sun, are you still with us?
I am. I know what I'll be doing tomorrow, too.
You know what you won't be doing, but okay. Go ahead. Yes, Joe.
My municipality, Bowling Green, is a municipal utility, and they signed up for one of these open-ended long-term contracts with a coal company out of Indiana, and it was the same promise. It'll be high prices the first couple of years, and then it'll go down, and it'll be well below market rate. Well, of course, what's happened is it's been many years, and the price is still double the market rate because now there's no incentive for them to actually lower their prices. Once they get a blank check, a generator will keep adding zeros onto the end of that check as long as they can. So I hope...
You know what I'd like you to do? I would like you to write an article about that. If you can, a few hundred words. Send it to me. I will post it at the PRN website and at nukefree.org, and we'll put it in the Columbus Free Press, either the next edition or edition after. Can you do that?
I can do that. I have an English degree.
Okay, so we only let people write for us who have English degrees, so I'm glad you called that. So please do send me that article. We'll get it around the Internet. We'll publish it. And everyone listening in, I want to thank Joe DeMar for helping to pioneer this electric boycott on the fourth anniversary of the beginning of the Fukushima accident. Remember, that accident is nowhere near over, and but it did start tomorrow, 4 years ago. And I remember, by the way, I work late. I work up till 3 in the morning usually, and one of the reasons I do that is because I don't get phone calls at 3 in the morning. But on March 11th of 2011, I got a phone call at 2 in the morning from my good buddy David Weiss in New York State, who told me to turn on CNN. And I wound up not going to sleep that night. I wrote one of the first articles, actually, that went out on the Internet. It was not a fun night, and we're living with that ever since. So thank you so much, Joe DeMar, and I look forward to getting that article. And people go to the website and turn down your electricity, as I will do. Thank you,
Beth. Thank you, Harvey.
Bye. All right, see you soon. All right. Rivera Sun, are you with us?
I am. Okay, I was glad to listen in on all that.
Well, thank you for your patience. We much appreciate it. You are an author, and looking at your picture here, you have really big hair.
It's not quite as big as that older picture, but it is still very big.
Well, I hope all my listeners can appreciate your hair. Maybe we'll post that picture at the website when we link up the article. So why don't you tell us, to begin with, about your house in New Mexico and why you're there and what about it that is so special here in terms of energy?
Well, Earth ships, a lot of them are completely off-grid. Ours is actually attached to the grid, although, like I said, we do use wind power for our electricity. But they're built into the ground, so they're very much a part of the natural environment. They have all south-facing floor-to-ceiling windows. Excuse me.
Is this a one-story house?
What's that?
Is it a one-story house or a two-story house?
Ours is one story. There are a couple two-story Earthships out there.
Uh-huh. Okay. Before we go further, wait. In fairness to you, and I want to make sure my listeners know, you are a much published author. You have a beautiful book I'm looking at here now called The Dandelion Insurrection, Love and Revolution by Rivera Sun. What are the other titles?
My first novel was called Steam Drills, and that was about coal and climate change. And my newest novel, which is just being in the community publishing phase right now, so people can get advanced copies, but the first edition will come out in a little while, is called Billionaire Buddha.
Billionaire Buddha?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we'll ask you more about what they're about when we come back after we get done with talking about your house. So you said you live with how many people live in your house?
My partner, Daryl Garner, and I live together in this Earthship, which is situated on a beautiful sagebrush mesa at 7,000 feet here in Taos, New Mexico. So at 7,000 feet in New Mexico, you do get snow. In fact, we had a huge snowfall a couple weeks ago that was about 12-plus inches, which is very large for the desert. And we don't have to heat our house in the winter. We have because of these south-facing windows, they take in passive solar heat, and they warm up the whole house. And then the house actually, all materials will absorb heat to some degree. What this house does is it reflects that back or radiates that back throughout the rest of the day. So, when we have a very long period of very, very cold, overcast weather, it's nice to start a little fire and sit by the fire, but it certainly isn't necessary for survival. The pipes won't freeze, the plants that are right up next to the windows won't freeze. Everybody will be just fine. In fact, when I'm on the road touring, which I am a lot this spring and for part of the winter, I can just shut the door and leave. I don't have to worry about anything. And there's no heat.
Now you said you have wind power?
We do. It's part of our local rural electric company's plan.
And what they have, the rural electric, do they own windmills or they get the wind power from other places?
Actually, ironically, and I can talk quite a bit about New Mexico renewable politics, they get their wind power from, I think it's North Dakota. which is really ironic. And, you know, politics is the reason we don't have local renewable energy. New Mexico should have been completely on solar 30 years ago. We have all the solar power that anybody could possibly hope for. And, you know, Joe was talking about those electric utilities and the contracts that are formed, and our little rural co-op was in one of those contracts for years and years and years, and they put a 5% cap on our renewable power. So
why?
We couldn't... It was part of the maintaining their monopoly on the power that we were buying. So rather than going and buying our local renewable power, we were constrained to only buy 5%. But we recently got out of that contract, which is very exciting and holds very good news for actually, you know, larger scale community solar infrastructure to be built here in Taos.
Yeah. Now this is something that's going on all over the country. My wife and I have a house in Los Angeles. We just got it because we just got two new grandsons and we're moving out there. But I talked to the solar people from Solar City, and he told me that there were limits as to how much solar they can install on our house because we are tied up to the grid. And this is a municipal utility. This is mm-hmm. just Department of Water and Power. And they're only willing to take so much electricity from our house. And they don't want us to go over the usage of our house and try and sell them electricity. They will refuse to take it. Now, when I get out there, I'm going to try and find out about this. I know that the LADWP owns part of the Palo Verde nuclear plants, three reactors in Phoenix, near Phoenix, Arizona. And why should my house be deprived of the opportunity to produce excess power and feed it into the grid and help other people be solar just because LADWP made a bad investment in three nuclear plants? Now, I'm sure that the politics of solar in New Mexico are very similar. What is the name of your utility company?
Our local utility company is called Kit Carson Electric Co-op.
And they're a co-op, but not owned.
What's that?
They're not owned by the community.
They are owned by the community.
Oh, so it's a municipal.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We're actually countywide, I think, is what we cover.
So you should be able to win this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, we are winning now. It was a very lockdown situation. But then actually Tri-State Electric Company, which is the big utility, was overcharging us and raising the rates and things like that. And so they got all hot and bothered about it. And they ended up in a lawsuit, which ended up reopening the contract. And citizens were really clear. They said, if you're going to reopen this contract, we want out of that limit. And so they're actually withdrawing from the contract because they got to open it. And, you know, there's a whole legal process going on. But it's very, very good news for us. And we're all very happy.
How many homes are there in Santa Fe, in Taos?
That's a great question. There's, I think, 20,000 people in the county.
So probably about 5,000, maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 homes in the town. And very clearly in New Mexico, and clearly as a double entendre, you could get solar panels on the rooftops of every house in Taos and be an exporter of energy.
Yeah, that's true. You know, out here we actually don't need to do rooftop so much, you know, because we actually do have quite a bit of land available for solar farms. You know, in LA it makes nothing but sense to put the solar panels on the roof because land is extremely valuable and extremely limited. Here we actually have the room to have the option to put them on the ground and run it as a small-scale utility farm.
Well, actually, I'm more partial to the rooftop because rooftop, then it's decentralized. And you don't have to worry about a grid. You don't have to worry about stringing ugly wires and worrying about vultures perching on them.
Yeah, you know, I would actually add that for me personally, and I can't speak for the electric co-op or for other people in Taos, I actually don't see exporting our solar power as being a very just or equitable thing to do when so much of the United States has the renewable energy resource to actually be employing and keeping the money in their local community. that I actually think, you know, we could rethink our entire way of doing business that in a way that would support and uplift more people rather than large-scale utilities and this massive corporatized grid that we have right now that's always been a monopolistic form.
Right. And so, you know, the ideal solution, I would guess, for a place like Taos is, first of all, the first thing you really want to do is have rooftop solar water heating. Water heating has been cost-effective for 100 years. And, you know, occasionally, if they're badly done, they can leak water heaters. But there's really, you know, unlike PV, which has been a little laggard in terms of cost because they're, you know, it's really expensive to heat water. And if you can do it solar, you will get a very, very rapid payback. And then, you know, but solar panels on a roof are the ultimate because then every home is independent. You don't need a grid of any kind. You don't do any environmental damage, which you might do conceivably with a, you know, a large solar farm. And, you know, and of course the jobs are there and all that. And also, by the way, people talk about solar panels, but there are also solar shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these, it's called amorphous silicon because it's flexible. And so with these roof shingles embedded with photovoltaic capacity, you can, you know, just re-roof your house and have solar energy from that. But if you are in Taos, New Mexico, and you have a municipal-owned utility, there is no reason why you can't take down the grid and be totally energy self-sufficient.
That's very true. There's also, you know, there's so many angles and issues in this, and I suspect your show covers them quite a bit about making solar affordable community-wide rather than just individual house by individual house. When you have a community that does not have a lot of income or resources financially, it's important that the community work together to provide solar options for everyone. And I think that's a really important question for Taos to talk about, since we do have a very large income gap between the poorer folk in Taos and the richer folk in Taos.
Right. Well, the richer folk in Taos, if they have any brains, will invest in solar and put panels on all the other houses in town.
Well, I hope they have brains.
Yeah. Well, people tend to think that rich people are smart. I tend to think the opposite, generally. I view rich people as people who have a certain ability to make money. I don't think it has anything to do with a broader intelligence, and we will. But I won't go too far on that one. Some of my best friends are rich. Okay, so Rivera-san, you are a multiple novelist. This Daniel Ayan Revolution, which I've been looking through, is very cool. Tell us the themes of your three novels, if you would. Well, first of all, tell us how to get them. You're with this one here I'm looking at is from Rising Sun Press Works. Is that your publisher or for the other ones, or how are you doing?
Yeah, that's my imprint that I've had since I was doing a lot of solo theater and I, you know, wrote my scripts down in books and used to sell them after the shows. That when I started writing novels, it made nothing but sense to just keep my own imprint and do what people call self-publishing, except I like to do it with a community of supporters, so I call it community publishing. But people can get my books on all the major online bookstores, and they can also go directly to my website, www.riverasun.com. You'll also find out how to get an advanced copy of Billionaire Buddha there, and very exciting projects always going on.
Well, it sounds wonderful. Where do you have your books printed?
We have them printed through a company called Lightning Source, and they do all printing in the U.S. So mostly they come from Charleston, South Carolina, and occasionally we get a different printer set up, which is in a different region of the country.
All right, so tell us about your first book. Tell us the theme.
Well, the first theme is coal and climate change, and it's set in Appalachia in West Virginia. And, it has a lot of social justice themes. I like to joke this is the novel about everything you don't want to think about. You know, there's mass incarceration, there's racism, there's climate change, there's income inequality, all of it's in there. And yet you're going to leave feeling very inspired and very warm in your heart about the potential, the possibilities that lie within each one of us for change. It follows a character who is a coal company lawyer and also another character who is a young black mother. And the ghost of John Henry makes an appearance in the book.
Oh, the steel-driving man.
Steel-driving man. Also, probably the historic John Henry was a victim of the old Jim Crow and caught in a mass incarceration system at the turn of the century back then. So there's a lot of parallels to today's world that are embedded in John Henry's story. I mean, there's lots of different interpretations of John Henry. Some people say he was white. Most people say he was black. There's lots of historical discussion about where the famous showdown with the steam drill took place. But anyway, that's way more information than your readers really want to know about, things that you get to investigate as an author.
No, it's terrific. Now, how old were you when you wrote this novel?
I was 30, I think. I was just turning 30.
And what inspired you to write a novel? What had you been doing in your 20s?
I'd been doing dance and theater. I was that's what I trained in college, and I'd run a dance theater company in the Bay Area, or the outskirts of the Bay Area in California, for 7 years. And I got involved in doing solo theater. I used to tour with 3 one-woman shows called The Freedom Stories of Lala, in which I would play 28 characters of all ages, genders, and ethnicities, and open up conversations about social justice themes. And then I, at some point, decided I need a little time in the desert and moved to Taos. And what happened after I got off of a tour 1 year was I came home and I sat down and I started writing steam drills. And it just poured out of me. I mean, it just came as if it was, I guess, being channeled, is one way people like to say it. It was a little bit more like wrestling than channeling, or maybe dancing is a better metaphor. Because it was quite a joy to write. And that kind of got me hooked on using the novel as a form of articulating the story of our times, the things that we're dealing with.
Wow, fantastic. How long did it take you to write that book?
Steam Drills was actually very fast. Steam Drills took me about 6 months. It was very, very fast process. And Dandelion Insurrection, that was a full year process, and Billionaire Buddha, the writing of it didn't take all that long, but it actually has had its own pace. It's like the baby that just doesn't want to come out too soon. It's definitely taking its sweet time getting to the public, so I'm very glad that it's at the point that it is now.
Well, tell us about Dandelion Revolution. You have characters here, Zadie and Charlie. Now, you know that Zadie, of course, is the Yiddish word for grandmother.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, my God. No, grandfather. Sorry about that. I was wrong. That's I am technically a Zadie, since I have 9 grandchildren. But tell us about this book, Dandelion Insurrection.
So the Dandelion Insurrection is a story about a nonviolent movement in the United States, a United States that's just around the corner of today, dealing with a hidden dictatorship that takes the form of the corporate state. There's a lot of themes that will be very familiar to readers. Militarization, climate change makes an appearance in the book. And then also a lot of our subconscious hopes and dreams and desires about movements that rise up to help us come together and to make change through nonviolent action. It's a really fun book. I always call it my adventure love story. And
why is it called Dandelion Insurrection?
Well, actually, the dandelion, which I only discovered this after I came out with the book, the dandelion has been an eternal symbol of people's movements. It just keeps coming up over and over again. In fact, the Movement for New Society, a very well-known and active group in the 70s, I believe, used to publish, I think it was called the Dandelion Journal. So, you know, it's a symbol of just a scruffy plant that is indomitable. It is golden. It is beautiful. And it has a secret of how it survives.
Which is
that every child knows you can make a wish and blow on a dandelion seeds. And if you blow them all off the head of the dandelion, your wish will come true. So we have just hordes and hordes of children ensuring the dandelion's survival.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. And then the last one, that's the billionaire Buddha amount. Not the
Buddhas,
I'm sure.
Well, you know, we are all the Buddha, but some of us seem to have forgotten that. The billionaire Buddha is the story, which is based on a true story, or I should say inspired by a true story, of a man who was extremely wealthy and lost it all and gave it all away. And learned the lessons of our interconnection with one another through his journey of giving up his wealth. And it's set in Central California and has themes that I think we'll all relate to, things that crop up in our own lives about wealth and income and about what is enough and how our personal choices either support the suffering that is caused in the world or refuse to cooperate with injustice and instead propose a different way.
How did this billionaire Buddha make his money?
In this story, he made his first fortune by logging.
Logging?
Logging. He made another fortune in tech industry and another fortune in high-end real estate development.
Did he lose them along the way, or did he keep building?
He kept building until he lost it all. The part that's inspired by a true story is that, you know, the world at the top of the world, the world of the extremely wealthy, the 0.01%, is not exactly what we think. We're sold glossy advertisements about this world, because they want us to buy into it. They want us all to support it. They want us to think that should be the aspiration of every person in society. But the truth is that it's very... your heart dies in the process of getting there. Sometimes quite literally. Other times more metaphorically. And that the world at the top is a very brutal and vicious and lonely place. That in order to amass fortunes in this world that we live in, most of them, I can't say all of them, but most of those fortunes are created by causing great suffering somewhere along the way. And I don't think our souls forget that. I think our souls and our hearts understand our interconnection with all beings. And that when we have amassed a fortune through those processes, part of us is hurting very, very badly. So the part inspired by the true story of the 0.01%er that I know is that his heart was breaking.
Wait. Do you actually know someone with $1 billion?
Not currently, because they lost it all and gave it all away.
So this is a true story.
Not all of it is true to this person's experience, but all of it is true to someone's experience. Although one part of it is true to my partner, Daryl Garner's life experience. So this is a story that has been a long time informing and a long conversation unfolding. And parts of that conversation, became the basis for this fictional story, Billionaire Buddha.
So your partner, at one point had money.
Yes, quite a bit. Not a billion, but many times over multi-millions.
Uh-huh. And then he met you and lost it all.
No, he lost it all before he met me, actually.
Oh, okay.
We like to joke that if I had met him before he had gone through this very profound inner and outer transformation, that I probably would not have liked him very much.
So you think he's a better guy as a pauper?
Well, he thinks that he's a much kinder, much more compassionate, much more considerate human being than he was when he had a lot of money. Yes.
Cool. Now, I have actually seen polls that say that people who have no money are happier than people who have tons and tons of money. Do you think that's true?
Well, Daryl does say that there are a lot of very, very unhappy people at the top of the 1%. And that, you know, money, we all know the cliche is that money doesn't buy happiness. But the reality seems to prove the cliche up, that it doesn't bring you happiness. And one thing that Daryl reflected on with me is that when you are extremely wealthy, you never know if people like you, or even your lovers or girlfriends or wives love you, or if they just are after your money. Or they love your money, or they love the lifestyle that arises with you and your money, and that it can become very confusing.
Three of my wives love me, and three are after me for my money, so it's hard to know. But yes, I'm all, you know, it's interesting, the whole dynamic of money. I mean, you wonder what motivates people like the Koch brothers to go out and wreck the world, even though they have each have about $35 billion in between them. I mean, what in God's name, or not in God's name, could they be doing trying to make more money at the expense of everybody else? It makes no sense to me whatsoever. You got any insights? And does a billionaire Buddhist, do you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, a lot of our extremely wealthy individuals are extremely dysfunctional human beings, I think is maybe the most accurate way to say that. Daryl describes both for himself and for others that he knew that the process of making money replaces the process of forging and forming authentic relationships with people, things that nurture and support you, and that amassing wealth becomes a sickness, it becomes a disease, just as, you know, some people abuse drugs, other people abuse money. So I can't, you know, speak for the Koch brothers because I'm neither them nor do I know them personally. But I do think that inside them is probably a very hurt human being who feels that they need money or power or both to feel secure in the world, to feel satisfied by this life experience that they're having. And I'd love to, you know, sit down and have a conversation with them about maybe they don't need to do that. Maybe there's better ways, cheaper ways. More cost-effective ways.
Well, I would love to videotape of the conversation between you and the Koch brothers. That would be exciting. So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left. Is there anything special that you want to bring up that I haven't given you a forum for?
Yeah, sure. One thing that I always like to speak about
You're a great guest, by the way. You have a beautiful voice. And,
thank you.
You're very coherent and to the point. So you've got your 8 minutes coming up. I bet you're going to make good use of them. Let's hear it.
Well, that's a lot of pressure. But, one thing I like to talk about is in all of my novels, there is a theme of both inner and outer and collective transformation. And with the Dandelion Instruction, one of the things that I feel very fortunate to have experienced in the process of researching for the book is understanding just how many tools and resources for making change we have, that nonviolent struggle or nonviolent action and nonviolent movements has been found in recent statistics to not only work, but that actually works twice as often as violence in about a third of the amount of time, with a much higher likelihood of success and a lower likelihood of casualty rates. So I like to share that with people so that they understand that, you know, the tools of Gandhi and King and Chavez and all the rest aren't just spiritual pipe dreams. They aren't just things that emerge and maybe save us all. They're actual practical things that we can research and learn about and become a part of. And, you know, since I wrote the Dandelion Instruction, I used to have a lot of readers, and still do, who would write to me and say, how do we make it real? And eventually, I wrote a study guide to the Dandelion Instruction, which is actually a study guide to how we make change. and how it's been done over and over and over again. There's been more than 50 nonviolent revolutions in the world in the last 35 years.
What do you mean by revolution? The complete overthrow of a government?
Yeah, a change of government.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I know, how exciting. These are the kind of statistics.
That would be a great thing, because most people think that, well, okay, you can use nonviolence to make some changes, but overthrowing a government, that's a big deal. Of course, we all think of Gandhi and the Quit Indian movement. And of course, I guess the Soviet Union fell by nonviolence, and you would probably wrap up about a dozen revolutions within that. But that's an interesting statistic. If you want to write that up, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'll send you some articles, because I have written a few for Truth Out and for Popular Resistance and a couple other places, too. There's a very wide field of this out there, and if you start to look, you will find lots and lots of information by people who are, you know, foremost scholars of this right now on the planet. I work with a group called Campaign Nonviolence, which seeks to bring the tools of nonviolence, both personal, interpersonal, and social political tools for change, to just ordinary people all over the world. And we're going to hold a conference in New Mexico August 6th through 9th on the theme of nonviolence or non-existence, which of course was Dr. King's famous quote about nuclear weapons. So we're going to mark the anniversaries. It's the 70th year since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with peace vigils at Los Alamos, the cradle of the bomb. And we're also going to hold 2 days of nonviolence trainings with not only Reverend Lawson, who is one of the strategists for the civil rights movements, but also with Erica Chenoweth, who is the co-author of a book called Why Civil Resistance Works, which did the research that proved that when you're trying to overthrow a government, expel a foreign invasion, or end a foreign occupation, nonviolent struggle works twice as often as violent means.
Good. That's great to hear. I teach a class, I teach a course at a couple of local colleges here, and I show the movie Gandhi, and we just got done talking today about Dr. King. There's no doubt in my mind that nonviolence is the way to go, and it certainly has its counterpart in renewable energy. Roberto-san, it's a joy to have you on here. What is your website, and tell us about your books again, please, before we have to depart.
Great. My website is www.riverasun.com, and you can find my articles on there. You can also find excerpts from all of my novels, which are Steam Drills. The full name is Steam Drills, Treadmills, and Shooting Stars, which is about coal and climate change. You'll also find The Dandelion Insurrection, which is kind of one of people call it a cult classic, and, you know, I'd like to see a few more readers before we actually give it that official status. And you'll also find The Billionaire Buddha, which is only in its community publishing phase, but you can get a copy of the book through our campaign on that, and everything is on the website, www.riverasun.com.
Now you say you go around speaking and dancing. Is that it? What is your touring regimen here?
Well, I actually don't do so much theater work anymore. My touring schedule this spring and a little bit in the fall too is about reading from the novels and speaking about nonviolence predominantly, and then also leading workshops that put these tools in people's hands, both on nonviolent action and creativity as in relation to social justice themes.
And you've been involved with the Occupy movement, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was part of our encampment in Santa Cruz, although peripherally, that was kind of my christening into real engaged activism. But I do run the radio program, Occupy Radio, along with my co-host, David Getchi Sierra Lupe, which airs every week, and you can find us at occupyradio.org.
Oh, that's so cool. And is that webcast?
It is. We're actually syndicated by the Pacifica Network, so we air on about 7 different stations around the nation every week, as well as putting out a podcast version.
Excellent. Well, hey, it's been a real pleasure, Roberto-san. We're about to hear Pete Seeger, David Burns, and Dar Williams with the Rivertown Kids sing our Soulotopia theme song. Be in touch with me. We'll post you up on our website. And good luck, Roberto-san. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harvey.
Yeah, don't you know we're gonna have a soul. Oh,